Good morning and welcome to this October 19th, 2016 edition of Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting to you live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org. We are always available via podcast. We are on Twitter at KUCI FM. We're on Instagram at the same place. Writers on Writing is on Facebook and Stitcher. I don't know anything about Stitcher, but I hear we're on Stitcher. So there is absolutely no reason not to tune in each and every week. I'm your co-host, Marie Stone. We are doing what we do every single Wednesday morning, which is talk with authors not only about their books, but about their writing process and creativity and craft, all the things that separate those of us who write from those of us who publish. It is my pleasure to welcome Patrick Phillips, and in the second half, I'm talking to Whitney Terrell about his latest novel, The Good Lieutenant, so stay with us for that. But first, Patrick Phillips. Patrick is an award-winning poet, translator, and professor, a Guggenheim and NEA fellow. His book, Elegy for a Broken Machine, was a finalist for the National Book Award. But it's his first book, a book of nonfiction, that will drive much of our discussion this morning. Blood at the Root, A Racial Cleansing in America, is published by Norton, and it's what we're chatting about. Patrick, welcome.
Hi, how you doing? Good morning.
I'm so sorry. It's live radio. You never know what's going to happen to us.
That's right.
All right. So I have given you a lovely introduction that you probably weren't able to listen to, but you you sounded fabulous. So
Well, I will take your word for it, and thank you.
So I'm going to let you take us into this book, and I know this is sort of a personal story for you, so I'll let you kind of set the stage, talk about Blood at the Root, and sort of what's happened in Forsyth that... Yeah, just take us there.
Yeah, so the book really is about the place where I grew up, Forsyth County, Georgia, which is the county in the Georgia foothills where my parents moved in 1977. We had been living in Northside Atlanta. And when I was about 7 years old, my folks moved there into what was then a really rural place, a kind of backwoodsy farming community, mainly a lot of chicken houses and cow pastures. And, soon after we got there, when I was in school, I noticed that my classmates almost exclusively used the N-word to refer to people of color. There were lots of racist jokes and racial slurs, and it just seemed to be a place filled with a lot of hatred. And yet I noticed that there were no black people anywhere around. And so when I asked my schoolmates on the bus, why they were so filled with hatred for black people, I was told this kind of mythic story for the first time, which in the version I heard from kids on the playground just went that a white woman had been raped and murdered by black men a long, long time ago in Forsyth County, the story went, and that in response, the white community had banded together and driven out all of the black people, all of the black residents. And this story really lived in my imagination because I could see that all around me, this was still the case. It was still a whites only place. So the book really began with my desire to try to figure out the true story that lay behind all of that mythology.
So, I mean, what combination of factors, because I feel like this story must have played out throughout the South during that time period in a number of places. And I'm just curious what combination of factors you think made this possible that what, yeah, go ahead.
Well, you're absolutely right. And actually, it played out not just in the South. It played out all over the country. There's a great book by a historian named James Lowen called Sundown Towns. And he looks at kind of the same issues I was looking at. I was looking at it very much on the ground level almost an hour by hour accounting of what went on in 1912. Lowen's book is the opposite. It's a sort of 30,000 foot overhead view of the entire nation. And in looking at census data, Lowen found evidence for this kind of purging, these kinds of expulsions in hundreds of places, if not thousands, all over the country. So, the thing that makes Forsyth County unique is really the longevity of it. In a lot of these places, a lot of the evidence that Lowen is looking at, he's talking about the Jim Crow era and on into the mid 20th century. But the kind of racial ban that I'm talking about in Forsyth was still in effect when I was a kid there in the 70s and 80s. So it lasted a very long time. And, when I looked at the original events in 1912, there were a lot of different factors. It seemed to be a place where there was a lot of anxiety, a lot of economic anxiety. Obviously, it's the Jim Crow South, and so there's a lot of just fundamental white supremacy in the air. And then there was, in typical to a lot of these cases, there was this kind of match that lit the powder keg, which was an two separate accusations of rape, in fact, during 1 week in September of 1912. And, you know, I think maybe the other fundamental ingredient is that in Forsyth County, legal mechanisms really never engage, so that there was never a response on behalf of the courts or on behalf of the local police to actually prosecute whites committing these crimes against black citizens.
Right. Yeah, I mean, even worse than that, it felt like they were complicit in the racism, you know, they're acting.
Yeah, you know, it's a complex, it turned out to be a much more complex white community than I had imagined. When I was told this story as a kid, it was really stripped of all the names and dates and places, and it was always told in very vague and mythic terms. And so part of my fascination with getting to the primary records of this was that the more I dug, the more complex the black community became in my mind, and the more complex the white community became. You know, I had been led to believe that this was a unanimously agreed upon decision of the white community, and that this was, you know, a kind of unified, you know, racial purge. And in fact, I found evidence that people like the mayor tried to stop this. The deputy sheriff, you know, stood up to a lynch mob outside the Cumming jail, tried to save a man who was lynched named Rob Edwards. And there were other people who wrote to the governor, wrote to judges in the federal judicial circuit, who were aware of what was going on and who were desperately trying to stop it. Now, of course, some of them had selfish economic reasons to want to try to stop it, particularly the mayor, Charlie Harris, who was trying to build a railroad into the foothills. But, you know, it was a more complicated thing than I had known. And there was conflict over between people who were hoping to end this and then the mobs who were going out, you know, anonymously and doing this at night.
Yeah. Ain't that always the case, that it's way more complicated than you originally set out?
Yeah. And the other thing is that, you know, the black community and the white community were much more enmeshed than I had understood. Obviously, in the Jim Crow era, I don't mean to imply that that was any kind of equality or equal treatment under the law, but I had always imagined a black community that was entirely poor sharecroppers and people with a very loose grip on their lives in Forsyth. And what I found instead is that there were educated men, there were educated school teachers, educated ministers, there were large property owners. There was a guy named Joseph Kellogg who owned 200 acres in the county. And there were just many more people in the black community who had very close ties to white people, especially in the upper echelons of the white society. And so the people who were expelled were very well known, often going back generations to many of the white people who either committed these crimes or who, you know, sat silently as this unfolded.
Interesting. But one thing you said earlier has just prompted this question in my head, which is, you said when you had originally heard the story, it was very mythical and unspecific, nonspecific, and kind of this fairy tale. And it makes me wonder if that is not a necessary ingredient in kind of racism, but a helpful ingredient, that you don't tell specific stories, you don't humanize it, you don't put individual faces on it, you make it kind of this mythic witch tale in a way. I don't know if I'm making
sense.
Yeah,
I think that's exactly right. And I think, you know, I could see in the, you know, this whole book is really grew out of the notion that the devil is in the details. And I think when I started looking, what I realized is that the ways in which the story was altered in the retelling over the course of generations had very particular purposes. So one of the things that I was always told was that the Klan did this. You know, this was a refrain. And in the time since the book has come out, you know, even looking at people's responses and things online, there are still people in the county who want to blame this on what in 1912 were considered, you know, outsiders. And that notion that Klansmen and outsiders and that the normal people of the county didn't do this, this was something that happened by a fringe element. That's an idea that was repeated over and over again when I was growing up there in the 70s and 80s. But, you know, it didn't take very much digging at all to debunk this story about the Ku Klux Klan being behind these waves of terrorism, in that I learned very quickly that the original Ku Klux Klan was prosecuted out of existence by the federal government in the 1870s. There was a law called the Ku Klux Klan Act, and they went after the perpetrators of violence in the 1870s, and the Klan disbanded. And it didn't really reemerge in the form that we know it until 1915. And that really happened because of The Birth of a Nation, the movie. So D.W. Griffith's film, in some ways, invents the modern Klan, and it's the Klansmen who are imitating the white-sheeted, torch-wielding, horseback-riding Knight Riders of the movie, as much as the movie was imitating the vigilantes. So, but the key idea there is that all happens in 1915, and that means that in 1912, it's simply impossible that these acts were carried out by, you know, what I had always envisioned, which was bands of dramatic, you know, hood-wearing Klansmen. And that then left the question of, well, if there was no such thing as the Klan, who did this? And, you know, I again, the devil's in the details. I found a letter written by a 14-year-old, a woman who was 14 at the time, named Ruth Jordan. And when she was 80 years old, looking back across her whole life, she wrote down an account of those months and things that she witnessed with her own eyes. And at the end of the letter, which she sent to her son, she wrote a sentence that really altered my understanding of the whole thing. And she said, it weren't the Klan done this. It was just ordinary people of the county. And, you know, that really confirmed a suspicion that had been growing in my mind anyway.
God, that's what is really interesting. Wow. My guest this morning is Patrick Phillips. The book is Blood at the Root, A Racial Cleansing in America. It is out and available now. It's published by Harper.
By Norton.
By Norton. God, you're right.
Yeah.
You know, that's funny because I'm sitting here looking at it, reading Norton and saying,
well, the people at Norton did such an amazing job. I need to make sure they get their due.
Absolutely. I need more coffee. Let's talk a little bit about, I mean, one thing that occurred to me is that place is really identity. And I started thinking about what it means coming from a place like Forsyth and, you know, that a place, not that it's your identity, but that, it kind of becomes this burden that you carry on your back. Like, you know, I come from Auschwitz.
Yeah. And I wouldn't object at all to saying that it's part of my identity. It is. And it's complicated. And, you know, this is one of the things that I grappled with in the book is, you know, my parents chose to move there in 1977. And I think, you know, my parents are both from Birmingham, and they grew up in the Birmingham of Bull Connor and George Wallace. So the racial strife and racism and bigotry was nothing new to them. And I think they had a very high tolerance, living in Georgia in the 70s for this kind of language and these kinds of attitudes. But nonetheless, you know, the fact that we chose to live there, that my parents chose to live there, and that I grew up there, you know, there's a burden of culpability that I think, you know, is something that I have to think about, and that's difficult, that we were there and our silence was part of the problem. And so writing the book for me was partly about breaking that silence and trying to no longer be complicit in the erasure of the Black community there, because really one of the most striking things after I learned all of this and did all this research is just how successful the purge was and how successfully the white terrorists really did erase all trace of these people having ever lived there. And I now know where their churches were and where certain property owners live. But if you go around there today, it looks like any suburban community in America, and there's absolutely no sign that they were there, and there's no sign in this, you know, county historical society of any of this. And I say in the book, you know, the history is written by the victors in Forsyth County. The victors really did succeed in wiping this out of mind and off the map. So, you know, back to your question, I think, you know, definitely my identity is shaped by all of that. And in some ways, deciding to finally dig into this story and to devote some of my time, you know, some of my life to it was about, in some ways, really turning back to that place and accepting that this is fundamentally part of who I am.
Yeah, I mean, we should tell listeners how successful this purge was, because at some point, I can't remember the exact statistic, but the population was like down to 39 or 37 Blacks compared to thousands.
Yeah, the population in the census of 1910 is 1,098, and that probably leaves out a few people. The census takers may well have missed some folks, but roughly 1,100 Black residents of the county. And newspaper reports make it clear that within a couple of months, of this accusation of rape. And a white woman named McCrow was found beaten and bloody in the woods, and she died from her wounds 2 weeks later. She was in a coma for 2 weeks, and she died. And that letter from Ruth Jordan that I mentioned, there's a moment in there where Ruth Jordan says that on the night of May's funeral, quote, all hell broke loose in Forsyth County. And that seems to be the real beginning of it in mid-September. And by the end of 1912, there are already people going through the county and reporting that there's not a single black person left there. So all 1,100 of those people were run out. And then you're right, there were a few exceptions in the census of 1920 and 1930 where, you know, first 30 odd people, and then eventually that dwindles to 17. And then eventually, you know, it is in fact an entirely white county after that.
Absolutely crazy. Tell the story about how you came to write this book. I love the impetus for this.
Well, you know, I tell the story in the book about a conversation I had with the poet Natasha Trethewey, who some listeners may know. She was U.S. Poet Laureate and, you know, very celebrated African-American poet and essayist and memoirist. And she is an old friend of mine from the poetry world. And Natasha happens to have gone to the University of Georgia to college, which means that she was in Athens, which is not very far from Forsyth, and in fact close enough that as a black woman living in Georgia, Natasha had heard some of the stories about Forsyth County. And, you know, when I was interviewing families of the descendants of the refugees from Forsyth, many of them told me about how among black people living in the Atlanta area, you know, when you were raising kids, you had to tell them about Forsyth County, and they needed to know that this was not a place that you went. And so Natasha had heard the stories, and, you know, years after I had left Georgia and when I was living in New York, Natasha and I became friends, and she heard me kind of casually mention that I had grown up in Forsyth County, and she really stopped in her tracks and, you know, essentially said, we have to talk, you know, because unlike most of the people I knew in New York, Natasha knew what it meant, to say that name, that that was the particular place I grew up. And, you know, after we, had been to a professional conference one time in a taxi cab, you know, riding home from dinner, Natasha really surprised me by asking me this very pointed, and she was, you know, we are friends, and I thought she did it in a kind but also a really determined way. She said, and she took a risk, because she said to me, why do you never write about that? Why have you never told that story? And she really challenged me and said, why do you think that race is only a subject for black writers? Natasha has written a great deal about race in her own work. And she challenged me on the fact that it was largely absent from mine, despite the fact that I had this really unusual personal background. And she said, you know, do you think you're not involved? And that moment really challenged me. And it took me a little while to really figure out how I was going to respond to that. But it really started me in the search, and I didn't start writing then, but I started researching then. And I started trying to find out everything I could possibly learn about exactly what happened and who, what, where, when, why, and how.
Yeah. And the research in this is just incredible. Your notes section is 30, and the type is very small, and the notes section is 30 pages. I mean, I can't even imagine what you went through and how many years it must have taken for you to research this, because it's meticulous.
Well, I can confess to being proud of the notes section, just because I, you know, this story was so often told. Sorry, there's a construction outside. There was so much kind of mist and blurriness and not confusion, but deliberate erasure surrounding this story when I was growing up, that I did feel maybe because I'm from there, I felt a particular obligation to document everything that I say in the book. And so I did want to leave the trail of crumbs to exactly where I was finding everything. And I became, you know, long before I put down a word of what eventually became Blood at the Root, I just became obsessively interested in finding the scattered pieces of the story. And that I had thought that this story was buried, but I think that's the wrong metaphor. It was really scattered, and a lot of the information existed, but it was just time consuming and required a lot of hustle to go and find it in newspaper archives and the state archives at Morrow and in the county courthouse, and then also in living, you know, in oral history, in the memories of some of the family members, the descendants of some of these black families who were forced out.
There's a great section in your author's note about going to visit this woman in her hospital nursing home, and her reluctance to talk about it. And I was wondering if you encountered that quite a bit, people just reluctant to share their family history and reluctant maybe to talk to a white man about their family history.
Yeah, you know, that I was always aware of that, and that was very real, and I realized a little, and I also, my background is as a poet, and so interviewing people is almost the opposite of sitting down to write a poem in a room by yourself. And I, you know, in the beginning, there was a learning curve for me. And one of the things, one of the first things that I figured out was that I wasn't going to make it alone. And for very understandable reasons, I was usually going to visit older people, a lot of people over the age of 80 who were, can you still hear me?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. You know, older people who were understandably reluctant to talk to someone like me and who looked like me and sounded like me. And so I got a real break and got lucky and got, you know, just the kindness of someone who was a stranger to me at the time. I reached out to someone at the Gainesville Hall County Black History Society, and Hall County is a place just across the Chattahoochee River from Forsyth, and that's where many of the black families went. So I knew that many of the refugees had resettled in Hall County, and I happened to have gone to high school in Hall, so I had some familiarity with the place. But I reached out to a woman there, and a Gainesville City Council woman named Barbara Borders Brooks, African-American woman, and a real organizer and a hub of a lot of people in her community, responded to an email from a total stranger, became interested in what I was doing, and she invited me to come down and speak at a meeting of the Historical Society there. And at that point, Barbara and I became friends, and so she really became my liaison to especially older members of the black community. And I just, every time I would try to schedule an interview, it would usually involve Barbara calling someone up. She frequently knew the people I was asking about already, and she would call them up and explain what I was doing, and then Barbara and I would go together. And I think that was really vital to getting some of these folks to talk to me. And then, the flip side of that is when I went to Cumming and up Forsyth County to interview people, I did grow up there. I did go to Cumming Elementary. I did play Little League baseball there. And so I knew a lot of the families of the older white citizens who I was interviewing. And I think some of them talked to me in a way that they might not have been as at ease or as willing to reveal some things if it had been someone from outside.
Yeah, that makes sense. That makes sense. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. I'm talking with Patrick Phillips about his book, Blood at the Root. It's published by Norton. You know, I always look at books at where they come in time, and I know I'm naive in saying this, but I feel like if this book came out 10 years ago, it would feel kind of like a piece of historical fiction that was interesting, but today it feels more relevant than ever. And, you know, I normally try to steer clear of too many political discussions, but I have to ask, mm-hmm. from your perspective growing up in the South and in writing this, you know, what the hell is going on in this country? You know, I just feel like we're still fighting the Civil War in some ways.
Well, I think one of the things that we're doing is finally debunking another myth and a narrative which is a kind of triumphalist progress narrative, and it's one that I around race, and this is particularly something, you know, that I think a lot of progressive or moderate whites cling to. And I was raised with this. My parents participated in civil rights demonstrations in the 1960s. My dad met a very young Martin Luther King. My dad's a minister, so he met a young Martin Luther King in Atlanta in the 60s. And they, you know, they did, I think out of very good will, they did raise me with a notion that every day America gets a little more just. You know, each victory in terms of a civil rights march or a movement or a law passed makes the country more equitable. And I think all of us, in the wake of Ferguson and Charleston and Baltimore, in the wake of Trayvon Martin and Eric Brown, Eric Garner and Mike Brown, Trayvon Martin, in the wake of all of these shootings, I think a lot of white people are having to confront the reality behind that myth, which is that we have a long way to go. And the truth is the kind of truth and reconciliation that we need and the kind of turning to face the past has never happened. And so what happens is these things in Forsyth County for 100 years, I read newspaper reports where white leaders in Forsyth would say, well, we're just glad that's over with, essentially, and no further trouble expected, all quiet at Cumming. You know, this was the phrase in 1912. Mm-hmm. And I read versions of that after racial incidents in the 1960s, in 1980, 1987. And I think there was just a lot of wishful thinking. So, you know, I feel most at home talking about the book on the local level, on the ground level, but I'm aware that it's arriving out into the world at a time when questions of race, questions of police violence, questions of our justice system are on everyone's mind. And, you know, I think I have to agree with Ta-Nehisi Coates, who's writing about the need for reparations hearings at the federal level, the need for a national version of truth and reconciliation where we turn and face all of this.
Yeah, yeah. No, I just think this is more a more important discussion than ever right now. And yeah, I appreciate your comments on that. I think that's right. I also wanted to talk just about, I think one of the other important lessons that comes out of this for writers, from your perspective as a poet, is crossing genres and not being afraid to step out of your, I don't know if the, how, I assume this is out of your comfort zone to step out and write a book of nonfiction coming from a poetry background. I just think that's great that we don't define ourselves.
Yeah, it was out of my comfort zone in a lot of ways. Obviously, the most risky thing is as a white man to tell these stories, and I didn't want to ever seem to be taking that narrative away from other people. And the folks who I most wanted to hand this book to were the descendants. And I've now gotten to do that on several occasions, which is really what I had in mind, was wanting to give them the story of their great grandparents and their great great grandparents. So that felt risky already. And then you're absolutely right in terms of genre. I've written three books of poems. The whole time I was working on this, I was telling friends and other writers that I wasn't sure I knew how to do it. Eventually, when I made contact with an agent, I was telling my agent, he wasn't my agent at the time, but I was telling him, you know, I'm pretty sure I can't do this. I don't know if I know how to do this. And I look back and I realized that is not how you pitch a book to an agent, is by repeating that you're pretty sure you don't know how to do it. But, that's just to say that it was a learning process along the way. And, you know, I think there's a tipping point where you do step out of your comfort zone and it starts to become really thrilling to work in this. You know, I've been at poetry for 20 years. It felt really thrilling to be doing something new. And I loved the research part of it. And when I got through with the bulk of the research and turned to actually writing it, you know, the time I've spent working on poetry served me very well, because then you're trying to hammer very complicated and nuanced and difficult ideas into sentences and paragraphs that read well and that communicate the full complexity. And, you know, that's a lot like poetry. So there were parts of it that felt like a big departure. And then there were other parts where I felt like, yes, I know I've been practicing this particular skill all those years that I've been working on poems.
And that really comes through in the writing. I mean, we do precious little narrative nonfiction on this show. We do mostly poetry and fiction, and it does read very poetically. It doesn't have the dry academic tone that a lot of narrative nonfiction can have. So I think your point is exactly right on.
Well, I hope that's true. You know, and I would say to all the poets out there, all of these genres, I think America has a much more rigid sense of the genre divides than a lot of the world. You know, I also translate from Danish, and the Danish writer I've worked on for years is a guy named Henrik Norbrandt, and he has published celebrated volumes of poetry, but he also has published a book of political essays about the current situation in Denmark. He published a cookbook. He's written a detective novel. I think Americans, maybe because so many writers are in academia, there's a way in which you're writing towards a job description, you know, and the job description doesn't usually say assistant professor of anything and everything that piques your interest. I think a lot of writers should be more bold about crossing those genre lines, because the skills of a poet come in very handy when it's time to write sentences and paragraphs and try to make it sing.
So true. So true. Tell people where they can find you. I know you have a great website.
My website is patrickphillipsbooks.com, and that's Phillips with two L's. And yeah, one of the things that really drove my work on the book was historical photographs. So I have a whole gallery of photographs. So if you'd like to see some of the people and places involved in the book, there you can see them at patrickphillipsbooks.com.
Yeah, fantastic. Fantastic. Patrick, thank you so much for taking the time today. This was fascinating.
Hey, it's been a total pleasure. Thanks so much for hosting me.
Thanks again. We're going to take a very short break, but please stay with me. Whitney Terrell will be on for the second half hour in a pre-recorded interview. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at KUCI.org. This show will join the other interviews up on the web and available to you via podcast. Feel free to visit us on iTunes. We're under College Radio. You can always visit Barbara's website, penonfire.com, for direct downloads, as well as information on past shows, upcoming shows, speaker series, events, and more. There is a fantastic speaker series event coming up next Thursday, a week from now. And I hear tickets are still available. It's proving to be a really great night. Bonnie Jo Campbell, Catherine Taylor will both be there. So highly recommend that. I'm your co-host, Marie Stone. Onward with the show. Whitney Terrell is the author of two previous novels, The Huntsman and The King of Kings County. He was an embedded reporter in Iraq during 2006 and 2010 and covered the war for The Washington Post magazine, Slate, and NPR. He teaches creative writing at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. His latest work is The Good Lieutenant. It's published by FSG, and it's the subject of our chat this morning. Whitney, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming on. This was fantastic. Totally gripping, totally unique. I am not a war novelist junkie, and so taking going into this world was fantastic. It was really a great read. So I'm going to let you introduce the novel. I can kind of guess where the idea originated, but I want you to kind of take us into this world and talk a little bit about it, the novel origins.
Well, that's interesting that you should say that you're not a war novel junkie. I mean, I'm hoping, you know, that one of the things about this book is that the main character is a female lieutenant, Emma Fowler. And the story is, you know, follows her. There are also other major characters, her lover, I guess, for lack of a better term, Dixon Pulowski, who's also a lieutenant, and an Iraqi character, Ayad Al-Taib. But the story really follows Emma's progress as a lieutenant through her career, how she begins taking care of her platoon, and then what happens to her in Iraq. The main story in Iraq is that she loses a soldier in a sort of tragic accident at an intersection, and then spends a significant period of time trying to get this soldier back. And in the effort to get him back, she does increasingly morally questionable things, I think it's fair to say.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And my hope and interest in writing about female lieutenants in Iraq is A, you know, the female soldiers who fought in Iraq and Afghanistan in these most recent wars are kind of amazing figures and are doing things that women have not done in combat ever before.
Yeah.
And also, I hope that maybe it would bring a wider audience to reading books about the Iraq War. I mean, I feel like there's a large number of people who aren't interested in reading about the war, in part because they feel like, hey, there's no one like me who's going to be in this novel.
Right.
And, you know, as far there have been very few novels that have been written with female protagonists that are war novels. And so this is one of them.
Well, and, you know, I mean, it to that point, it's a fairly new phenomenon, right? I mean, this is one of the first wars, probably from 2000, that women are really actively engaged in the military. And so I feel like this is a story that's kind of unfolding over time as it's happening in, you know, in real events. She was such a gripping character. Tell me a little bit about, I know that was an important choice for you from the beginning, was to write about, from a female point of view. But talk a little bit about that, some of the challenges that it may have posed and kind of accessing her mind and getting her just right, because she's such a complex character, as all of your characters are. But tell me a little bit about how hard it was to access the female point of view.
Well, that's really kind of you to say about her as a character. I appreciate that. And, you know, I wanted to write this book from the point of view of a female soldier from the very beginning, before I ever went to Iraq. It was an instinctive choice, but I think if I were to recreate why I wanted to do that, I think that it's helpful in any organization that you're trying to talk about to have a character who's an outsider to that organization. And in a lot of war novels, that character is a draftee, somebody who doesn't really necessarily want to be in the service. But that really isn't the case with the soldiers in Iraq right now. It's an all-volunteer army. So I had this sense that, you know, I mean, the army is one of the largest, most patriarchal organizations that you could possibly imagine. And I just sort of figured that the female soldiers who were part of the army would be in that outsider position, which in a way put them a lot closer to me.
Yeah.
As an outsider coming in as a journalist.
Hmm.
And I feel like an outsider has to learn the organization in a way that somebody who the organization is designed to serve doesn't. And then when I started interviewing female soldiers in Iraq, and then afterwards, that turned out to be an accurate sort of guess.
Yeah.
I remember meeting a woman named Jen McDonough, who was a captain at the time in Iraq. She had told me this story about trying to retrieve a stuck vehicle from a muddy field with a vehicle called a Hercules, which is the same vehicle that Emma Fowler uses in the book. It turned out to be a 5-day mission to get this vehicle out.
Wow.
She got this Hercules stuck. It's a huge treaded vehicle like a tank. She got another one stuck. Her soldiers triggered a 500-pound bomb.
Oh.
A Humvee of hers hit an IED and was flipped over. Infantry soldiers tried to rescue her. They got stuck. It was this incredible ordeal, which she was in charge of the whole thing. And after telling me this extremely long story, which I'm abbreviating for radio, she said to me, you know, the hardest thing about being here is that I don't have anyone to talk to.
Hmm.
And what she meant was that, you know, she had women who were beneath her, in other words, in rank, who she commanded. She couldn't really talk to them about any doubts or fears or concerns she had as an officer. And she didn't feel like she could talk to her superior the male officers who were superiors or equals, because they would dismiss any uncertainty she expressed as, well, that's just a girl.
Yeah.
That's just a woman speaking.
Yeah.
And so I think that it's easy for readers to identify with someone who's in that kind of position.
Yeah. Yeah. It's funny. There's a video, you know, I was just kind of searching the web on some stuff that you've done for the book, and there's a great video, kind of a behind the scenes of this book. That interviews some women soldiers, and one of them said, you know, the perception is, I'll have to modify my language for radio, but the perception is you're either a witch, a slut, or a lesbian. And to overcome those stereotypes and to really step into what is essentially one of the only worlds that is really a man's man world, and be taken seriously and be, you know, taken, you know, to command respect and to, in a hierarchical situation where, you know, people are below you in rank that are male, and trying to break into that world is incredibly unique. But yet, the feelings that it evokes are very universal.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I have also spoken to women's organizations like here in Kansas City and in other cities where, you know, they've done studies. These are organizations that are composed of like women who are, you know, executives in business organizations, and they've done studies where they're looking at how female officers dealt with being in the Army as a template and a way to learn about what it's like to be a woman in corporate life.
Wow.
You know, in America. And I think there are some very obvious parallels.
Yeah.
The difference being that, you know, for instance, Stacey Moore, who appears on that video, she's a major who was stationed at Fort Riley. Stacey told me a story about a platoon sergeant of hers who wouldn't carry out her orders and was sort of felt like he was sort of trying to intimidate her in Iraq. And at one point in their office, their talk, which is the abbreviation for that, DOC, she finally had to fight him. She fought him. She wrestled him to the ground and sort of pinned his head between her knees and was pulling on his ears until some soldiers broke it up. And
wow.
That was how she resolved that problem with her platoon sergeant. That is not a normal day at the office for most people.
Right. Wow. I guess you have to play by their ground rules, and their ground rules are more physical than, you know, civilian ground rules. I guess. Wow.
That's definitely true. I don't think that's the case for every female officer, but I do think, you know, physical violence is what people are there doing,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah, right.
I mean, and one of the challenges for Emma in the book is that she has to learn how to talk to her soldiers, who her platoon happens to be all male, in the way that they want to be talked to. You know, she begins her career as an officer as somebody who really wants to follow the rules. She has a nickname of Family Values Fowler. And the reason she wants this is that she has it leaving a fairly complicated family life. And she thinks, look, the Army is an organization that's going to have simple rules. There's going to be command structure. You know, I give an order, somebody follows it. I follow orders. Everything's going to be good and simple and clean. And, of course, that's not what being in the Army is like. And part of her progress into becoming a good lieutenant is learning how to talk to her guys in the way that they want to be spoken to, you know.
Did she change much over time? Your original conception of Emma versus how she came out when the book was done, did she kind of stay as you had originally imagined her, or did she evolve quite a bit?
You know, she really pretty much stayed the same. The thing that changed was the structure of the book. You know, the problem that I had with the original draft, which was written in chronological order, was that family values version of Fowler, when she's, you know, a goody-goody and trying to do everything right, it's an axiom of writing that good characters are less interesting than bad or complicated or flawed characters, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so I couldn't get the beginning of the book to work the way that I wanted to, and it wasn't until and we should probably mention it at this point, until I decided to tell the story in reverse, which is what the novel does.
Right.
It starts with Emma Fowler at the involved in a very terrible IED event in which several of her soldiers are killed, and she kills an Iraqi civilian in the middle of this event. And the book then, each chapter goes backward in time from that moment to sort of explain how this happened.
Yeah.
And the Emma Fowler you meet at the beginning of the book is quite complicated and dark and complex and to me much more interesting. And so the end of the book is really her beginning as a lieutenant before she's ever deployed. And then when she's Family Values Fowler, you have the echoes of who she is going to become in the background as you read those pages, and they seem much more interesting, at least to me.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I'll remind our listeners that you're tuned in to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. I'm talking with Whitney Terrell about his latest novel, The Good Lieutenant. So let's talk about that. The structure is definitely the most interesting writing lesson for our writers.
Totally nuts! I can't believe I did this!
I can't believe you did this. No, I know. As I was reading, I was like, first of all, yeah, I don't know how you pulled this off, but I don't even know if there are any templates for doing this before. I mean, I remember the movie Memento did this cinematically. I can't think of a ton of novels that do this.
You know, I did find one after I'd started doing it. I was about halfway through reversing the text. There is a book, a really good book, by Charles Baxter called First Light, and it is Charles Baxter's first novel.
Okay.
And it's about a brother and sister, and it is structured pretty much the same way that The Good Lieutenant is structured. And I would encourage people to read it. It's really a beautiful book.
Okay. He's a master. That's hard to, because it's not only telling a story, you know, events backwards, it's also character, as you're alluding to, it's character change backwards. It's what has happened over time that has affected this person's psychology and informs the decisions that they will make that led them to be where they are. And doing that backwards, I mean, it's hard to do it forwards. It's, I imagine, you're like dancing with Frank Sinatra, right? Is it Ginger Rogers who said, I have to do all that and backwards in heels, is kind of how you wrote this book.
I hadn't thought of that. That's interesting. That's a good quote. You're right.
So tell me a little bit about what that looks like. I imagine your office is a mess with papers all over the place trying to keep this straight.
Well, this happened when I was at a point of utter despair because, you know, I felt like the ending of the book was far too negative and deterministic. In other words, it came to a very narrow point in Emma. It was a very damaged character at the ending. And I couldn't get the beginning to work, and I was thinking maybe I'll just make the end of this a short story, and I couldn't even do that because the ending felt like it came down to such a narrow point. And having asked myself that question, I was in my totally destroyed office with papers all over the place, and I accidentally got a part of the book scene from earlier in the book underneath the pages that I was looking at the very end. And so paging through, I saw a scene from earlier, and I had the idea that if I told the story backward, I wouldn't have to move away from my belief that, based on my experience, combat can be a very devastating experience for soldiers.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a character-building thing.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, if I told the story backward, the characters, as they moved away from their combat experience, would grow as humans and become more complex and more full, and that the novel could work that way, and then it would have that sense of expanding outward that you want as a novel sort of reaches its conclusion. So that was how I discovered that. It was sort of a response to having run into a brick wall in the structure of the book.
Yeah. I heard somebody describe it as, comparing it to the explosion that happens at the beginning of the book, that it's really this blast that then you follow the explosion pattern out in time is how the novel kind of tells itself, is mirrored in that first explosion scene. I thought that was really beautiful. That's kind of a nice metaphor for how it was put together. But
I'll take it.
Yeah, right. And then you had talked about it, this just being like, you know, taking 10 years and tunneling through, you know, you'd described it as tunneling through rock. And I wonder just kind of what kept you going, both narratively, what compelling thing kept you going when, you know, you were hitting rejection and stumbling blocks, kind of what allowed you to persevere, both narratively through the book and just, you know, physically the stamina-wise to do this?
Well, I mean, I always tell, I teach creative writing at our MFA program here at UMKC, and I always tell writers, look, you know, you're going to reach a moment in a book when you don't think you can write it. And the only cure for that is to have chosen a subject that you personally are invested in and you feel like, look, I have to tell this story. For me, the touchstones for that were, I was in college during the Gulf War, in 1991.
Mm.
And I had a friend who fought in that war, and even though that war was generally considered to be a success, quote unquote, it was very devastating for this particular individual who fought in the war, and it changed his life. It's hard to say this caused this, but for me, I always felt like that had been a traumatic experience for him that nobody acknowledged or wanted to talk about. He ended up committing suicide not long before I embedded in Iraq. And so I had this sense when the war was starting in 2003, when we were preparing to invade Iraq, that this was not going to be a good thing. I was a war opponent. It made me nervous to see how excited the country was to go to war.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to be able to speak about it. I wanted to be able to comment on it. I felt that this was something that was going to last a long time. And so I began to get involved in reporting on it and eventually setting up those embeds that I did and meeting soldiers and learning what happened so that I could write about it. So all of that investment and the personal interest in wanting to be able to speak about this war, which I thought was an important cultural event in America, those are the things that keep you going if you've got some bedrock point that you're trying to make.
Mm-hmm. Did you see you sought out the embedding your embedded assignment as opposed to them? Did they come to you, or did you go to them to do this?
No, I found people to embed with. You know, in 2006, the novel is set in 2006, and I was there in the summer of 2006. And, you know, that was a really rough time in Iraq. There was a Shia shrine. The Al-Aqsari Mosque had been bombed in February by Sunnis, and a civil war was starting in Iraq at that time. People didn't really know for sure that that was what was happening. But the area of operations that the battalion I was with the area they were patrolling. There were, you know, dead bodies showing up in fields that they didn't know who was doing the killing. Villages that they were going up to patrols through would suddenly empty out and there'd be nobody there. And also the insurgent attacks on that battalion were really ramping up at that time. That battalion ended up losing around 19 people over a period of 3 or 4 months. So it was very dangerous. It was very frightening. And, you know, that atmosphere is sort of what I try to get across in The Good Lieutenant.
Yeah. Did you see things differently writing about the war as a journalist versus writing about it as a novelist? Like that lens shift of reporting versus fictionalizing, does that have any impact on how you see the events? Does that make sense?
Well, the only way that I've ever learned about anything, I'm a really bad archival researcher, you know?
Yeah.
So I'm a good, however, just showing up with a notebook. I mean, I started off, my first job out of college was as an intern reporter at the Kansas City Star. So for me, being able to write a novel that's set in a foreign country during a war, you know, the point is to learn enough that you have entire piles of information that never make it onto the page. And you also, as a reporter, you know, you're trying to get a story, but while you're there, you know, you're taking pictures, you're smelling things, you're touching stuff, you're seeing what stuff looks like. There are all kinds of thousands of little tiny moments, you know, that are necessary to sort of be able to have the full fabric of what a novel is going to feel like, you know.
Yeah.
And so to me, the two things are co-joined. Obviously, you know, in a novel, in a reporting story, you're just going to get the quotes. You've got a story. You write your lead. You write a longer piece. I wrote a long piece for the Washington Post magazine about that first end. But there's so much other stuff. I have all these just piles of notebooks at home and piles of photographs. And I mean, I started working on this book long enough ago that I have piles of taped interviews on cassettes, you know, with
right.
people.
Right.
You know, so, but, you know, there really, for me, there was no substitute for being present.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I guess the other kind of sister question to that is whether living through the reality in some ways makes fiction more difficult, because you have all this stuff and you're like, oh, well, this thing happened and I really want to talk about it, but it's not necessarily serving the story. It's not what the story needs. But yet I'm kind of wedded to it because it was, you know, something interesting. And I sometimes wonder if living through something makes it more difficult to fictionalize it, because, you know, you have to think story first, right?
Yeah, I mean, yes. And I think that's one of the reasons that it took a long time to write this book. I mean, just showing up at Camp Liberty the first time, this is a very large American base that was connected to Baghdad International Airport. There's 40,000 people on that base, roughly, when I got there. And so the size and scope of an installation like that, I mean, there's, you know, trailers in rows, like huge subdivisions. There's, you know, mess halls that feed 5,000 people at a time, gyms, movie theaters, bus service, you know, traffic jams. Just that in and of itself was such a surprise. You know, I hadn't expected us to have that much infrastructure there, you know. And so finding your way to tell a story that isn't overwhelmed by the sort of incredible and intense reality of the war and all the things you're seeing, that was hard. It took some time.
Yeah, right. The other thing is how much to educate your reader about the war, because as I said, I'm either your perfect reader or I'm your worst reader, because I really didn't know a lot about Iraq beyond sort of, you know, normal amount of news consumption and seeing the Hurt Locker, which could still be more than some readers, I guess. But I still feel like there's a lot of backfill of education necessary, and yet you don't want to bog the reader down with, you know, like a current events lesson. And so, I just thought this book handled that so well, of getting the details right and keeping your reader up to speed without it feeling like, you know, here's all the stuff that I have to tell you to make you understand what's going on.
Well, again, I would put you in the ideal reader camp, Dan. That's a very, very kind thing to say, and something that, yeah, I thought about a lot. How many acronyms can you use? What things do people know and what don't they know? And you're thinking also at the same time, I'm thinking about a general reader, but I also want soldiers to be able to read this book and think, hey, this is accurate, you know?
Yeah.
So, yes, that's a very difficult line to balance, and you work very hard at it. You know, I studied with John McPhee in college, and John is one of the greatest creative nonfiction writers of all time.
Yeah.
And John was great at writing about process, about how things are done, how a piece of equipment works. And so much of that style of writing that I learned from him comes into this particular novel. I mean, he had things, he calls it a set piece when you're describing a process. And there are tons of processes in this novel. I mean, I have to explain how the Hercules works. You know, how does it tow vehicles? How does the winch work? You know, what does it mean to go on a patrol? All those things are process writing, and they can be included in a narrative if you're careful and smart about it. And you have to have them balanced with narrative and story as well. And that's just part of the craft of writing, you know.
Yeah.
But John is a person that I would go to for really excellent process writing like that.
Yeah, it's so good. It's so good. I'll remind my listeners that you're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. My guest this morning is Whitney Terrell. The book is The Good Lieutenant. God, I hate drawing down on time, and I have so many more questions. But I do want to talk about writing. There's some wonderful Iraqi characters in here, sympathetic, multidimensional, all kinds of wonderful characters. And I wanted to talk about writing from that point of view, too. Accessing that mindset, if that gave you difficulty, and tell me a little bit about those characters.
Well, it was really important to me to write from the Iraqi point of view in this book as well as the American point of view. You know, there's a movie, American Sniper, is an example of a movie that I feel like glorifies war to a certain extent. And also feels inaccurate to me based on my experience in Iraq. And one of the issues that I have with a movie like American Sniper is that the Iraqi point of view is totally non-represented. They exist in the story only as a reflection for how the main character feels, right? So in the opening of that movie, Chris Kyle is trying to decide whether or not to shoot a woman who has a child with her. But that child story is never told. The child exists only as a sort of symbol of innocence, that it's going to hurt him if he has to kill this child. Well, but what about the child himself? You know?
Right.
And so for me, it was crucial to have Ayad Al-Tayyib be a character, and also Faisal, his friend, yeah, who's an interpreter for the American Army. You know, I found a guy who lived in my neighborhood in Kansas City, who it turned out lived and was in Iraq in 2006 in exactly the same area where,
wow,
where I was embedded.
Wow.
Khaldun Ahmed, and he's in the acknowledgments of the book, and he was my crucial person who I went to for all of that information, you know, and talking to him about what it was like to live there during the time, and having him read the passages of the book that involved the Iraqi characters, and, you know, developing a wonderful friendship with him also in the process. I learned so much in getting to write those passages that, for me, they were a real joy. And Ayad is one of the, you know, he's one of probably the most innocent character in the book, in a way.
Yeah.
And so in some senses, his passages were the easiest to write.
Yeah. Yeah, it's funny. I mean, even discovering, I hope I don't give too much away, but even discovering that he's deaf, you also learn that kind of backwards. I mean, that whole structure, the way the book is set up, everything is done that way. And I found it even in smaller details. And I thought that was just so lovely. And so, you know, that small things are reflected in the overarching way that you told the story.
The thing about a book going backward is it's not going to be about, well, what's going to happen? It's going to be about, why did this happen?
Yeah.
And so you have to gain the reader's trust. You know, the reader's going to read something and say, well, why is this way? Why did he act like that, right?
Right.
And I have to enter into an agreement with them that they can trust me that I will provide those details, you know, as the book goes backward.
So good.
And, you know, if you get those a few times, you're like, okay, my questions will be answered if I read ahead, you know, and that creates the narrative pull, hopefully, to drive the reader on into the past.
Exactly right. Yeah, exactly right. And I also wanted to talk a little bit about setting, because writing about a foreign setting, you know, we have our television and movie images, but having gone from writing about really classic Americana in your previous novels to writing about a place so foreign, did that present a challenge? Do you find it almost easier to write about a place when you're not physically in the place and then, you know, you have some distance from it and can reflect on it? Or talk about kind of bringing Iraq to life.
Well, I love describing landscape no matter what. And it was, you know, my great-grandfather and grandfather were both painters, and so is an uncle of mine. And I started as a writer as somebody who, like, wrote only landscapes. There was no story whatsoever. Descriptions of places, you know. So for me, there were some surprising things about the landscape west of Baghdad, which is where the novel is set, you know, that in fact it looked a lot like western Kansas, which is where Fort Riley is, and
wow.
is near where I live. That it was fairly verdant, that there would be fields of grain, that there would be a lot of agriculture going on, that there would be, you know, date palms and eucalyptus trees and canals filled with water, and that those would be an important feature of the landscape. And I felt like people didn't imagine Iraq that way. They just imagined it as like everything in the Middle East is just one big desert, and it's not. So that was fun for me to get to, and interesting and challenging, but to get to write those scenes. And in a lot of ways, it felt very familiar, not foreign.
That's important.
But I wanted to say one thing is, you know, I mentioned that I was an opponent of the war, but, you know, that's different from being an opponent of these soldiers, you know.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, the idea of the book for me originally was that to try to tell the story of someone who I thought the reader would find morally, would morally agree with, you know, a good soldier, a good lieutenant, and show how someone like Emma Fowler, placed in a situation like Iraq where the mission is somewhat unclear, where the original impulse behind the war isn't something that you can hold on to, and put them in a situation where they can make a series of decisions that the reader would think, oh, I understand. That's why she did that. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, I might have done that. Oh, that's a good decision, too. I get that. And yet that series of good decisions can and did for many soldiers lead to bad outcomes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of the full arc of the book in terms of thinking about it, you know, thematically, what I was trying to do.
So good. So good. We're totally out of time. And we didn't get to your reading. This is killing me. Are there things we should have talked about that we didn't, or advice that I know you teach writing, advice that you give students, or pitfalls that you see people kind of routinely make that you can talk us out of making?
Well, I mean, the only thing that the main thing that I learned from this book was to think about your novel structure before you've worked on it for 6 years.
Right.
You know, I was somebody who came to structure in novels intuitively, and by structure I mean chronology.
Mm-hmm.
And this book was so easy to write once I figured out the structure. And it was so hard before I had it right. And if I'd thought about it consciously beforehand, I think I would have written it a lot faster.
Although, do you think that it took what you went through to get to it? I mean, I wonder if there really was a shortcut, or if you just had to do what you did and it turned out this great. I mean, maybe if you came to the structure earlier, it would have been easier, but it wouldn't have been as rich, and you wouldn't have spent all those years thinking about these people and their plight, and, you know, I mean, maybe there was a purpose to all
possible.
Those years.
I will say I don't regret the years that I spent working on this book, you know?
Yeah.
And once it comes out, it feels totally worthwhile, and you forget the pain,
yeah.
which there was plenty.
Yeah. It's like childbirth. In many ways, I think book writing is like that. I think, you know, it's... yeah, you forget the pain, but it's also, you know, it really is creating something new out of nothing. And it's, you know, there's nothing more worthwhile, I don't think. I wish I could do it.
When you get a chance, like we're doing now, to talk to a reader, it makes everything worthwhile. I mean, the partnership between a reader and a writer is one of the most amazing things from the writer's point of view, because someone like you and hopefully people in your audience, you know, when they come to the book, they have to participate, you know, in making it a document and a story. And when you find somebody who fully participates in that and gets what you're trying to do and has ideas about it and even has ideas that you hadn't thought of about it, that it's so incredibly satisfying that it makes all that time worthwhile. We're striving for that kind of communication.
Yeah, yeah. Good. Whitney Terrell, this was incredible. Thank you.
Thank you so much for talking to me.